Well, it's a real pleasure to be here today, and I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. And I'd also like to thank the Department of Homeland Security for letting me out of the NIH. It's quite a trick these days.
The question is, will they let any of us in?
All right. You know, in our lab we do experiments and theory, but in honor of my being able to speak to an audience that has quite a number of distinguished physicists in it, I thought I'd like to emphasize some of the theoretical aspects today and talk about these mesoscopic models. Now, what's a mesoscopic model? It is not a phenomenological model, and it's not a macroscopic model, but it's not a microscopic model either, because we don't deal with molecules in their full gory atomic detail. We use simplified models of in this case, proteins. And my job today will be to convince you that these simplified models contain a significant amount of reality in them, and even to the point that we can do some very nice quantitative predictions of things that we subsequently observe experimentally. So I'm going to talk about three effects that I believe are important within the context of looking at the behavior of proteins in a real biological environment. The first of these effects is the effect of very high overall concentrations of soluble proteins in certain cellular compartments. For example, this is a cartoon of the surface of a red blood cell, and it contains some surface receptors, it contains a lot of hemoglobin molecules inside, and it contains some molecules out here in the blood plasma, immunoglobulin, fibrinogen. And the point is that each of these compartments inside the cell contains a very, this particular intracellular compartment contains about over 30% by weight hemoglobin. And this plasma contains maybe about 8% by volume of proteins. And the question we want to add, and this I should point out that in other intracellular compartments in, say, higher organized eukaryotic cells, you have compartments such as mitochondria that contain proteins up to perhaps close to 500 grams per liter. So all of these biological fluids contain very high joint composition of macromolecules, if you include both proteins and polysaccharides and nucleic acids. And they occupy a substantial fraction of the volume. So a long time ago, we began to ask the question, what does the volume, high volume occupancy in these solutions have to do, for example, for the with respect to the association of two trace molecules here, say this red yellow molecule and this blue molecule, or between the interaction between this molecule, this immunoglobulin, and then, say, some cell surface receptor? All right, that's one effect we want to think about. A second effect is due to the high degree of structuring in most eukaryotic cells. You not only find soluble macromolecules, but a large fraction of the protein is present in structures, such as microtubules and actin filaments and a variety of other cytoskeletal fibers. And cross-linking elements. So what happens is that the fluid part of this cytoplasm is broken up into little interstices between these structural elements. And a lot of the scale of these interstices is that they're not really a great deal larger than the proteins that might want to pass through these interstices. So I began to think about what might be the effect of putting proteins in small pores. And that's another thing we're going to talk about. The last thing I'm going to try and talk about is another factor that comes into play inside cells. Now, here's a picture of some red blood cells, and here are two proteins that are fluorescently labeled. And you see that in these red blood cells, the hemoglobin is pretty uniformly distributed. But this enzyme, glycolytic enzyme, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, is primarily associated with the surface membrane. And it's associated in a nonspecific and reversible fashion. And this is true of a number of glycolytic proteins are found to be significantly associated not only with cell membranes, but with cytoskeletal fibers. And in fact, you can see a large degree of localization in muscle fibers. And it's believed that this is related to their function in these living systems. So the last thing I'm going to talk about is how nonspecific surface adsorption might affect associations of proteins. So we can think of these effects as two kinds of effects. First of all, if we have a free energy diagram for an association reaction, in this case, let's think of just a simple bimolecular association. So this might be two separated reactants and a heterodimer or a homodimer, and this would be the transition state between them. And this would be that free energy diagram in a dilute solution. Now, if we now take that same system, same concentrations and everything, but now we surround it with a lot of other molecules, which I'll probably be referring to as background molecules or pores. We'll see how that comes into play. There's two ways that those background the elements, either molecules or structural elements, can influence this reaction in a nonspecific way. One way would be that there would be some kinds of associations, and you'd stabilize, but you wouldn't stabilize all the states of the reaction equally. So, for example, in this system, you'd have a preferential interaction, stabilizing interaction with the products. So you drive this reaction to the right. But another possibility is, and one that isn't so frequently recognized, is that you can have destabilizing interactions, which don't result in complexation. And I'm going to show you how one of these repulsive interactions from excluded volume can fall into this category, that repulsive interactions can destabilize all of the species, and by preferential destabilization of the reactants relative to the products, you can also drive this reaction to the right. But in this instance, you don't see any complexes being formed. So people have, at least in the context of biology, have tended to not think of these kinds of interactions. They are interactions. They're repulsive interactions. And you have to look for them in a different way. And you have to think about them thermodynamically. But I'm going to try and convince you that they're no less important than attractive interactions. So here's a simple paradigm, again, for this reaction. This is that hetero association I told you about. And this is taking place in dilute solution. And I'm going to say that we know this reaction. We've measured it in dilute solution. We know the equilibrium constant for this reaction. Now, I want to find out the effect of putting this into a solution containing a lot of volume-occupying molecules. And the way I do this is by building this thermodynamic cycle. And so I can look at this as this. There's a certain free energy here that's involved in this transformation. And we can think of a free energy associated with the insertion of this molecule into a crowded environment. And that is reflected in the context of a partition coefficient. So this is the partition coefficient for putting A into the crowded medium. And here's a partition coefficient for putting B into the crowded medium. And of course, there's one for putting the complex into the crowded medium. And these, again, being free energies, being additive, if we now add all these free energies around here, we can calculate the free energy change of this. But since we don't know this, this is just a reference state. What I really want to do is I want to calculate the ratio of this to that. That tells me the effect on this reaction of putting this into the crowded medium. So I'm going to calculate this environmental factor gamma. Okay, and that's good because I can calculate that simply by calculating these three partition coefficients. How do I go about doing that? Well, let me tell you a little bit about excluded volume first. I know some of you know this real well, but allow me to bring the others up to speed. So we have a solution here. This is just a simple illustration that is a unit of volume. This isn't a boundary. It just specifies a unit of volume that contains some hard particles that occupy about 30% of the volume of this, 30% of this volume. Now, if I put a little tiny particle into this solution, that little particle can occupy essentially all of the volume here except the volume that's actually occupied by the black molecules. So if these occupy 30% of the volume, this has access to 70% of the volume. All right. Now let me tell you something about the free energy of putting that in. The free energy depends not just upon the total volume that's available to it. It actually depends upon the accessible volume, because there's a certain entropy associated with putting this into the solution. So there's an entropic cost of restraining this from everywhere into a certain concentration here, and that's really a function of how much volume it can access in this system. So the chemical potential, which represents the change in the free energy of the system with respect to the addition of a tiny amount of this particle without changing the total composition, is actually augmented. This is the part that everybody knows from first year chemistry, that there's a standard state free energy change for putting it into a dilute solution. And then there's a configurational entropy term that has to do with the indistinguishability of the particles. But there's also a part due to solute-solute interaction, which, at least when I was an undergraduate, people tended to treat this as some kind of a small fudge factor that you put in to make everything come out all right. And in fact, the origin in the particular case that we're only dealing with steric hard particle interactions, there's a very simple expression for this additional free energy term. And it's a function of the ratio of the total volume to the volume that's accessible to the center of mass of this particle. So here we have this particle goes in and it sees 70% of the total volume. So this is about 1.25, something like that. The logarithm of that is very small. So this really is a term that we can, to a first approximation, we can ignore. But now let's look at the system where we want to put a particle of equal size into this volume. So this particle cannot approach any of the other large particles to within twice the radius. And I've drawn that distance by a shell around these other molecules. So the center of mass of this molecule cannot be within any of those shells. All right? In fact, the center of mass of this molecule can only go into the area that's outside of any shell, which are just these little tiny interstices here. This is a problem that is a geometry problem, and it's been solved approximately by people who work with the theories of liquid states. And you can solve this problem, and you can calculate the amount of free volume in this system. And it turns out that when these particles that are already there occupy 30% of the volume, the volume that's available to this other particle is not 70% of the remaining volume, it's less than 1%. So this term actually turns out to be of the order of 100. And that number is, if you look at this term, it makes this 4.6 RT. Well, 4.6 RT is a substantial number. That's we're getting into chemistry here, okay? 4.6 RT is not something to laugh at. All right? So this is something we have to keep in mind. And what are some of the consequences of that? Well, we can do some simple models let's just talk about hard particles, hard spherical particles right now. So here's a calculation based on scaled particle theory, and it is the excess free energy of inserting a single hard sphere, suspension of spheres of type C, okay? And the first thing I want you to notice is that in biology, we're looking at this region here. We're not looking at this region. We're talking about fractional volume occupancies that can go anywhere from 5%, but more typically, in terms of cytoplasm, upwards of 25 to 40%. So the first thing I want you to see is that for a fixed size of T, that is, I've selected a particle now that's the same size as the crowding particles, this number goes up in a very nonlinear way, and it goes up in a nonlinear way with increasing occupancy of C. And as you can see, it can get quite large. You see, here's 100, a factor of 10, 100,000, 10,000. Now, is that a good model for molecules? Well, my first clue was back in the 70s when we were thinking about hemoglobin and the polymerization of sickle cell hemoglobin. We were looking at we can actually experimentally measure the thermodynamic activity of hemoglobin by a variety of techniques, classical physical techniques, osmotic pressure, light scattering, sedimentation equilibrium. You get the same answer with all of these methods. So you can actually measure the activity coefficient, that's a measure of the excess free energy of putting the hemoglobin molecule into a solution of hemoglobin molecules. And you see this curve? This curve is exactly the same as this curve. I mean exactly. Hemoglobin is nature's answer to the hard sphere. And that point is this point. So we can exactly predict the activity of hemoglobin up to the highest measurable concentrations with this very, very simple model where we treat hemoglobin as a hard particle, and the size of that hard particle is exactly the size of the hemoglobin molecule. It's a sphere with a radius of 29 angstroms. So that was really an eye-opener. And since then, we did a lot of other measurements, and we found that there's a lot of proteins you can do this with. And so you see, sometimes very simple models do work, okay? The other thing I want you to keep in mind is that as you increase the size of that particle that you're inserting, there's also a very nonlinear increase in the effect as the size of the particle you're inserting increases relative to the size of the particles that are already there. So here we are. You can see that was the hemoglobin molecule, but if we want to put something larger in there, we're going to have to pay because it's harder and harder to find a space in those other hard particles. And that costs a lot of free energy to put them in. Okay? Now, is this also true? Well, here's a measurement, experimental measurement of the activity coefficient, or actually directly it's the partition coefficient. This activity coefficient is derived from the partition coefficient of a whole bunch of molecules partitioning into a gel. Okay? And interestingly enough, one sees, and you can see the range, it goes from very small molecules all the way up to proteins almost 300,000. First thing you see is that, forget about the line for a moment, but just look at the points. And the points have a common functional dependence, with some scatter, to be sure. But you can see, basically, there's a common functional dependence. And that tells us that the interaction of all of these proteins with the gel is dominated by their size, not by specific interactions. Okay, that's a good thing. And, of course, there's a shape dependence, too. And that probably accounts for the scatter here. But the interesting thing is now, look at the curve. That curve is a very, very simple excluded volume model. And the only structural information in that model is that I model all of these proteins by spheres with a radius that's proportional to the cube root of their mass. That's all there is. And it does a pretty good job of accounting for this trend. So another vote of confidence for this mesoscopic approach. Now, how does this affect associations of proteins? Well, if you look at the volume that's excluded to this background molecule by two monomers, that's the volume that's excluded to the center of mass of this particle by these two monomers. And I think you can see that when these two monomers form a dimer, the volume of that's excluded to this molecule by the dimer is less than two times the volume excluded by the monomer. So it turns out that by allowing molecules to associate, you're reducing the amount of excluded volume in the system. You're lowering the free energy of the system. So in this manner, the presence of this black inert molecule is helping these molecules to associate. Is that clear? If there are any questions, stop me. I hope this is clear. Yeah?
I have a question about the plot before.
The previous slide.
The previous slide.
Yeah.
What about the concentration?
These were dilute proteins, and we were measuring their preference for being in a gel versus out of a gel. Okay? So we're looking at the volume that's excluded to the protein by the gel.
What type of gel is it?
That was dextran gel.
So it's just into a gel with dextran?
Yes.
Gel.
Yeah, it could be either. It turns out you can do these experiments very nicely by just size exclusion chromatography. Okay, so how would you expect now this crowding to affect reversible associations? All right, here's the model calculation. We allow n spherical monomers to form either a spherical n-mer or a linear n-mer, which I model as a sphere-cylinder. Okay? And we can do these calculations very simply, scaled particle. And the volume of either of these monomers has to be equal times n times the volume of this. And here are the numbers that we come out with. Well, if you look for a formation of a dimer, you can see by the time we get up to about 30%, which is a kind of a good benchmark, you can see that. And by the way, these monomers are the same size as the crowders. Okay, so that all has to be taken into account. But here we have a factor of 10 enhancement of the association constant. And you can see there's a little difference between the sphere and the sphere of cylinder, because the sphere of cylinder is not as compact as a sphere. In fact, the sphere is the smallest, has the least excluded volume of any particle with a fixed volume. Okay, it's very easy to show that. It's the most compact. All right, as you go up to form a tetramer, you can see that the magnitude of the effect goes up. So we're now looking at effects of between 2 and 3 orders of magnitude enhancement in the association constant. And of course, going to the sphere is slightly more favored than going to the sphere of cylinder, but it's still a very, very large effect. Now, what can we say about the effect of crowding on reaction rates? Well, there's two possibilities. The first possibility is that the transition state is very close in overall structure to the final product, the final association product. And we think that that's probably the case for most solution reactions, because the attractive interactions are short-ranged. So that transition state is probably a pseudo-dimer. Okay? If that's true, then the crowder, with respect to the crowder, that excludes volume to the crowder just more or less like the dimer. So therefore, this energy shift is going to be roughly the same as this energy shift. And what you see is that the forward reaction rate is increased and the backward reaction rate is largely unperturbed. All right? That's not going to be perfectly true, but we think it's probably approximately true. Okay? The major effect will be on the association rate constant. Now, remember, this is a transition state rate-limited reaction. When you go to diffusion rate-limited reactions, where the encounter rate is the dominating thing, the encounter rate always goes down. So you might initially see an increase in the reaction rate, but if you get to a high enough degree of crowding, ultimately it's going to turn around and go down, because at some point when it's diffusion-limited, everything's going to slow down, and ultimately you're just going to have a gemisch that nothing's going to move at all. Okay, so you're not going to have any chemical reactions. But for these very slow reactions, you'd expect the crowding to increase the forward reaction rate. Again, there are, under some circumstances, and we can talk about this if anybody's interested later, but not very usually. Sometimes you can see a situation where the transition state looks like the reactants, in which case you'd expect to see the major effect on the reverse rate, the backward rate constant. But this is not the usual case. The usual case for slow reactions is to increase the forward rate. Okay. Excluded volume is totally nonspecific, so you'd expect it to influence any reaction that involves a change in excluded volume. So crowding should, in principle, affect folding reactions, it should affect association reactions, it should affect chaperone reactions, it should affect the formation of hetero and homo oligomers, it should affect the formation of large arrays of native molecules, it should affect the formation of amyloid, a partly folded molecule. And we've looked at a variety of these reactions. We've looked also at folding, but that's not the subject of this talk. Be happy to discuss that in conversation sometime during the coffee break. But what I want to talk about is three different reactions that we actually have looked at in our laboratory. The formation of homo oligomers and native proteins, the formation of amyloid, and the formation of arrays of native molecules. So I'm going to go through these very briefly because we can talk about experimental details later. They're a whole story in themselves, but I want to just give you the bottom line of these investigations. We developed a technique for looking at the association of molecules in the presence of large concentrations of other molecules. And I wanted to show you this one because this is a illustration of the association of fibrinogen. Fibrinogen is a monomer in the absence of calcium and in the presence of proteins. But interestingly enough, when you have calcium that's comparable to the levels of calcium in blood plasma, you start to see a slight tendency to associate. But interestingly enough, when you go to add high concentrations of serum albumin, which is also present in blood plasma, there's about 50 grams per liter serum albumin in blood plasma, this molecular weight of this doubles. The average molecular weight doubles. Well, this is telling us something. It tells us that maybe the state of fibrinogen in blood plasma is not a monomer. But, I mean, the folk wisdom is that it is a monomer, but maybe it's not. Actually, right now I'm collaborating with somebody. We're trying to look at measure the state of association of fibrinogen in a kind of synthetic blood plasma that mimics many elements of real blood plasma. But this is a non-trivial thing. We're actually changing the size of this protein by adding an unrelated protein. We know that the serum albumin is not co-aggregating with the fibrinogen here. We've heard a lot about amyloid. I'm not going to tell you anything about amyloid, but I want to tell you that I collaborated with Jeff Howlett and Danny Hatters, and Danny spent some time in Chris's lab, who have this wonderful system. It's a very, very well-characterized system. I think possibly the most carefully studied amyloid system from a physical chemical point of view. And I spent some time in their lab and suggested to them that, maybe we should add some crowding agents to this to see what happens. And they did that. And lo and behold, we saw a really remarkable increase. And, of course, Tony Fink has remarked on this also. But I think we got this result before you got yours, or at least contemporaneously. But here we're looking at this thing, really significant crowding effect. And we looked at it three different ways. We looked at turbidity. We looked at the precipitation of protein and measured the amount of the depletion of non-aggregated protein as a function of time. We looked also at thioflavin T binding. And in all cases, we got the same result. We got a substantial acceleration of this reaction. It's an irreversible reaction. You wait long enough, it will go to completion, and there won't be any unaggregated protein left. But the neat thing about this is that we were able to, with a simple hard particle model and really no fitting at all, just using structural information that we could get from the electron microscopy of the fibers and the size of the monomer and information that we already had about dextran, we were actually able to predict the slopes of these plots. See, the intercepts are different because the amount of protein that's aggregating is different. But the theory predicts that the slopes should be parallel. They are. And we were actually able to predict the slopes of those plots from a very simple excluded volume model. So in this case, we believe that volume exclusion plays an extremely important role in determining the rate of this formation of this amyloid.
What other hypotheses went into that prediction? So the excluded volume.
No, that's it. That's it.
Else was needed.
Remember, yes, because I don't have any theory for why this is different than that. I only have a theory for delta G, okay? So it's the slope that we predict, not the position.
And how did you had the dextran, how did you...
You model the dextran as a random matrix of hard rods. There's a very good theory due to Ogston and to Giddings that we can talk about. In fact, I'll mention that later, okay? Or we can talk about it afterwards. It's a very, very simple, nice, highly predictive model for the effect of polymers on proteins.
But you have a diameter for the dextran.
We do. Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
That number.
The radius. The dextran is modeled as a rod of approximately 7 angstrom radius.
So yeah. The prediction sensitive to this, the input for that diameter?
Well, but we got that diameter from a whole lot of other measurements. Okay, yes. It's a parameterization, but we didn't fool around with that. We took that from other measurements and it turned out to be directly transferable to this system.
But generally is it sensitive to the number if you didn't know? So
it would it turns out that there are two numbers that can balance each other off. Okay, so you have to combine one of the numbers. We can talk about that afterwards.
Well, you can ask the question another way. Supposing you just use the excluded volume and use the scale particle theory, then what sort of percentage difference are we talking
about? You can't model polymers by hard spheres. Large polymers you cannot model by hard spheres.
But random rods?
Random, long random rods, yes.
In a gel, but not in a random polymer, surely.
Yes, because it turns out that the protein's only interacting with a short segment of the polymer. It's not interacting with the particle as a whole. Yeah. All right, this is the last experimental example for crowding, and it's known that under these conditions, namely in the presence of colchicine and GDP, tubulin exists as this very large double ring array of about 50 alpha-beta dimers. So this has got a molecular weight of about 5 million. And if that is, but it's soluble. But interestingly enough, when you add magnesium, these rings start to aggregate, and they form large, I believe, planar rays. At least they appear to be planar when you look at them and regularly packed in electron microscopy. And this is reversible.
This is
alpha-beta, yeah. We're talking about 50 alpha-beta dimers, okay? So there's about 5, and each alpha-beta dimer is about 100K. So this is about 5 million, but it's forming this indefinitely large array. And this is work that was started by Damien Paul, who's presently in Chris Dobson's lab, when he was in my lab. He's sitting in the back. Yes. And we were able to work out a very nice light scattering technique by means of which you could measure the weight average molar mass. And if anybody's interested in this experimentally, we can talk about it afterwards. We could actually measure the weight average molar mass of this protein as a function of time. So we'd start off here with 5 million. This is 5. You notice this is a pretty large molecular weight here. So we start off with 5 million. And at 0.1 mg per mil tubulin, we add magnesium here. And you see it does something. It starts to aggregate a little bit. Mg to mil to 0.5 mg per mil, still in a dilute solution, you get some aggregation. There's a burst, and then you get some aggregation. Okay. Now what happens when you take 0.1 mg per mil of tubulin and you put it in different concentrations of dextran? Well, one thing you see is that even before you put the magnesium in, the molecular weight is going up. And this is work that really has to be followed up. This work was done just about the time we had the mad cow scare and our tubulin source dried up. This was calf brain tubulin. So we unfortunately suffered a precipitous halt in the work. And so what I'm showing you is as far as we got. It's very enticing. And if there's anybody here that would like to come to my lab and do some more work on this, I'd love to have you because it's very exciting. So these were the preliminary and final results that we got. So here's you add 35 mg per mil, you add 50 mg per mil, you add 100 mg per mil, and the rate just shoots up. It just shoots up. So this is an incredible acceleration. And I believe that these results are preliminary, but I believe they're semi-quantitatively correct. So this is kind of exciting. And you notice we're also getting an increase in the weight average molecular weight pre-magnesium. So there's something interesting going on there too. Anyway, those are the three things I wanted to show you that really indicate that these simple excluded volume models have a lot of predictive power I think they capture the essence of what's going on. And you can elaborate on them and you can certainly make much more sophisticated models, but I think in terms of capturing the essence, we're doing okay here. And we've been able to predict a lot of other things with these very simple models. Now I want to go on to these two other effects. The first of this is that effect of confining a particle to a small pore, which I think is really a situation that you encounter very much inside a eukaryotic cell. Perhaps less so in prokaryotic cells, but certainly in eukaryotic cells where there's a lot of internal structure. So it's the same idea. We want to look at the free energy of partitioning each of these species into a pore, and then we can calculate the effect of that, of having these particles in the pore, on their association constant. So this is an excluded volume too, except we're not being excluded by other soluble molecules. We're being excluded by the boundaries of this little container we put it in. Now the way we do this is really simple. We can calculate the partition coefficient for these particles using a ratio of configurational integrals. And actually, the configurational integral is just a continuum expression of a grand partition function. So I mean, this is statistical mechanics. This is real easy. But it's the trick is now coming up. The trick is coming up with simple models for this interaction that you can do the integral with. Okay. So what do we have here? This epsilon is the energy of interaction with the pore boundaries for a particle that's in that pore, one particle in the pore, as a function of its position, which is a bunch of radial coordinates, and its orientation, which is a bunch of orientational coordinates. All right? And in the bulk, of course, there's no interaction, so epsilon is zero, so it's just this. So that's the partition coefficient. That's all there is to it. It's very beautiful. The trick is, again, coming up with an expression for this so you can do this integration. So here's some simple models. So let's look at this hard wall interaction. All right. So the potential is this. If any part of the particle intersects the wall, then that's an infinite interaction potential. Or if it doesn't intersect the wall, there's no interaction potential. All right. So if we integrate over the bulk, we just integrate over all the positions and orientations in this volume. Now, if we now put this in the pore, the same volume in the pore, we can see that this is okay. It doesn't intersect the wall. So its energy is zero. And likewise for this one. But this one intersects the wall, so it's forbidden. So basically, that configurational integral, the partition coefficient is given by an integral over all allowed conformations over all conformations. Is that clear? That's just for a hard wall interaction. All right. So here's a very simple quantitative illustration of that. We want to put a spherical particle into a cylindrical pore. So here's the volume in bulk. All right. It's a two-dimensional problem, right? It's independent of the length of the pore. So here's the allowed volume. This center of this particle can go anywhere in this volume. All right. So that's this business. Now, this particle can only, the center of this particle can only occupy this volume, this area, which is this. Okay? So the partition coefficient is just the ratio of these two. Very simple. This is extremely intuitive. But I want to show you something here. This is a gas. So here, what we're going to do is we're going to model proteins as particles, as hard spheres, with a mass that is, the radius is proportional to the cube root of the mass, okay? And so now we can do this. We can calculate the partition coefficient as a function of the log of the mass of these proteins or particles, all right? Now, so here it is. That's the equation I used to calculate this curve. Now, this is real experimental data. This is partition coefficients determined from size exclusion chromatography of a whole bunch of proteins in a Cepheidex gel. And you can see that it has this characteristic shape and it pans out. And you can see that this would correspond, for example, to the salt volume of the gel. And this would correspond to the void volume of the gel. And you can compute the partition coefficient from this. Now, I claim that the main features of this curve, well, first of all, look. They're basically all fall on the same curve, and it shows that with there's some exceptions here. You see, a very nonlinear particle doesn't fall on that curve. This is fibrinogen because it's a rod, it's not a sphere. But most of these are fairly quasi-spherical and they fall on this curve. And that curve is amazingly like this curve. Well, this curve was derived from that simple idea of putting a sphere into a cylinder. That's how powerful that model is. So it's very, very. Of course, this is not a cylinder. It's more complex than that. But the main physics are reflected in this very simple partition function.
And the M max is experimentally determined, essentially.
Oh yeah, that just corresponds to the radius that's so large it can't go in anymore. That's when the radius of the particle is the radius of the.
Is that a parameter or is that measured?
No. That would be like a fitting parameter. That would correspond to a zero. That would correspond to the mass where you don't have a zero partition coefficient. Okay, so we did these kinds of calculations for simple model particles of different shapes, okay? And we put them in pores of different shapes, and we were interested in what the notion of confining in one dimension and in two dimensions and in three dimensions. And we also put the particles into, this is just one element. These were done with periodic boundary conditions, so they're infinite arrays, so we could put this particle into a matrix of rods or into a lattice of a meshwork, a cubic lattice of meshwork, and we could compute these partition coefficients. And we could get an estimate of how much free energy it takes to put these particles into pores of different sizes. So for example, here's the free energy of putting a rod and a sphere of equal volume into pores of different sizes. So this ratio would be the bulk. Of course, everything, there's no, you, if it's in the bulk, that is the pore is infinite size, then there's no extra free energy. But of course, when you get to the radius of the sphere having is half the diameter of the pore, that's it. You can't put it in anymore, so it diverges. But you can put a rod in. It costs you more energy because you have to orient the rod to get it in there. But that's the idea here. It costs energy, and the energy is shape dependent and size dependent. So what is the effect on associations? Well, you can see here, again, we're putting, in this case, we're looking at, for a monomer to an n-mer, and we're looking at the effect, okay, that ratio to the bulk. So this is a large pore, it's getting to, the pore is now twice as large as the particle, and here it's the size of the monomer. And what you see that as the amount of association goes up, you do get a significant effect. But you see, you get that significant effect for a pretty small pore. It has to squeeze down quite a bit before you start seeing a large enhancement. And again, if you look at the association to form rod-like, indefinite rod-like arrays, we could pick some parameters in the bulk to give us a distribution like this of particle sizes. And when you squeeze down the size of the cylinder, you squeeze it towards longer and longer distributions of these linear polymers. Okay? But again, you have to get down to a pretty small pore in order to be able to see these effects. The other problem is, of course, that the molecules don't like being in the pore. They'd rather be in the bulk. So you only see these effects if you force them to stay in the pore. So if you didn't force them, so if you force them to stay in the pore, then the degree of oligomerization goes up. But if you allow them to equilibrate with the bulk, the amount of oligomerization goes down. Why? Because the larger particles are being squeezed out preferentially. And in fact, the total amount of protein goes down as you squeeze down the pore. So these kinds of effects you only see if they're really confined in the pore, okay? And you don't allow them to equilibrate with the bulk. All right? Now, the last thing I want to talk about is what happens now if we have some kind of an attractive interaction with the confining boundary. And this is really, I think, very important, and particularly important inside cells, because there is a lot of surfaces, and we know that these surfaces are generically sticky. In our lab, we found that a large number of enzymes that are unrelated in any way tend to adhere to cytoskeletal filaments. And in other labs, this has also been shown too. There's really a kind of a generic stickiness that we really can't afford to ignore. Plus the fact that if you take like 1 cc of solution and put it in a test tube, the amount of the volume of that solution that's within a protein diameter of the surface of the surface of the tube is about 1 × 10⁶. But if you do the calculation for a cell and you put in all the membranes and all the fibers, it turns out that ratio goes up by 5 orders of magnitude. So it's between 0.1 and 1. So surfaces are there. They're present in enormous, enormous abundance. So if you're thinking about cellular processes and you ignore surface interactions, this is what happens if you ignore surface interactions. Looks good here.
If we can follow the tradition. Yeah. So if I think of something that might, like your rod.
Yeah.
So supposing I think of the cytoskeleton.
Yes.
Now, from the point of view of a smallish protein, that looks like a curved surface.
and yet you seem to convince us that you could get away without worrying about an adhesion to it, but mainly just its extrusion.
Well, you're talking about the polymer.
Well, no, I'm just talking about the general question. I mean, what you basically argue when you argue that extruded volume is, you know, most of the story, which I'm not disagreeing with, but you're also implicitly arguing that there's nothing very important in the way of binding onto...
It depends on the system you're looking at. If I put in a dextran polymer, I can demonstrate unequivocally that there's no association of the dextran and the protein. So in that case, there is an exclusively repulsive interaction.
So that means, though, that you've done a separate calibration experiment of some sort before you apply...
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about an experiment carried out in cells. These are all experiments are in vitro, and we very carefully look for heteroassociations or adsorption. In other systems, we see absorption, and I'm going to talk about those experiments.
So that was an important feature of the dextran.
Yes.
Relative to the proteins.
But you know, other proteins also have exclusively repulsive interactions. Some of them have attractive interactions, and it also depends on the pH, you see, because under certain circumstances you can have proteins that have different net charges, and by manipulating the pH you can shift from attractive to repulsive interactions. So yes. Now, excluded volume is something that is added on to any other interaction that you have. So it's biasing it in a completely nonspecific way. But I'm not telling you to ignore those other interactions.
No, but you didn't mention how I knew when I could ignore it. That's okay. All I'm getting at.
Is it a little more clear now?
Well, it's a little more clear. I mean, I don't know what specific experiments you did to conclude the text.
Well, for example, in that amyloid, we actually examined electron microscopically. We looked for any kind of co-aggregate. Those fibers that were formed in the presence of the dextran were absolutely identical to the fibers that were formed in the presence of dextran and absence of dextran. We also looked for co-sedimentation by centrifugation. We did a lot of tests.
Could I use the argument backwards and say the fact that you got good agreement with your theory, where you calibrated the dextran separately, was again evidence?
Yeah, I think so.
And
yeah.
Conversely, if I've got significant disagreement.
Absolutely. Yeah. Are we getting back online? Okay. Yeah.
Reminds me of the questions while on this section. So in Tony Fink's talk, and he added PEG,
yes.
Went up and then went back
down. Yeah. I think he was right. I think he went through that. He mentioned that he thought it was viscosity. I wouldn't call it viscosity. I would call it really congestion, because viscosity... It infers that it's feeling it's the viscosity of a polymer solution doesn't really the viscosity of the water that's in between the polymers. What you're doing is you're bumping off. We have a model for the effect of particles, hard particles, on diffusion coefficients of other proteins, and you can see it go down.
But you grant him an effective viscosity.
What? An effect? Yeah, it's sort of an effective viscosity. Yeah.
Well, in fact, we did some experiments with glycerol to perturb the viscosity. And so it sort of goes up due to osmolite type effects at lower glycerol concentrations. And then when the viscosity gets about 10 times the normal, then it starts...
It becomes diffusion limited. And crowding always slows down a diffusion limited reaction. Okay. So we're back trying to look at our sticky surfaces. And for the way I...
At least at the bottom.
Right. I don't want to turn this thing off. I didn't do that, by the way.
No, it's...
Okay.
It's a new system.
Didn't like me. All right. So again, we're gonna use a strategy that was very similar to the confinement strategy. It's an enhanced confinement strategy. This time we're gonna look at the partitioning of in this case, small pipette-shaped molecules into large pipette-shaped pores. And in the simple case, we can look at a planar pore or a square pore or a cubical pore to look at confinement in one dimension, two dimensions, and three dimensions. So what we're going to do in this case is we're going to model a self-association or a heteroassociation as, in this case, self-association of a cubical monomer, in this case 4, but it could be n, into a larger cube with a volume of 4n, or it could be 4 cubes in a row, so that would model a rod formation of a rod-like particle, or we can model the formation of a plate-like particle by putting into a 2x2 or 4x1 array. Okay? That's the basic idea. and we're going to only allow six different orientations in this model. And so these are the six orthogonal orientations that this particle can have and still have its sides parallel to the boundary. Now, why do I want those sides parallel? I'm going to tell you, because the potential that I'm going to put in requires that. But let me show you something. You think, oh, instead of doing all the orientations, you only do six orientations. That could be dicey. Well, it does simplify. It does simplify the calculation of this, because now...
I'm missing something.
Yes.
Can you go one slide back, please?
Yeah.
What is the difference between... One more slide. What is the difference between the top and the bottom case?
This one?
Yeah.
Well, this is every side is equal, you see.
You only have four particles.
Does it?
You only have four particles.
There's four. That's right. So this the radius of this is this is V. This is a cube with a volume of 4V.
Okay. So they can change it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what I've done is I've taken all these different possible orientations and I said, well, now we're only going to make six orientations. So now the integration of orientation is just six, okay? And now for each of those six orientations, now then we have to sum all overall positions. Now, is that a dangerous thing to do? The answer, thank goodness, is no, because we can compare calculations done for all orientations with calculations done for six orientations, and you see a little bit of difference. This is a little bit of difference, yeah. But look at it. If you squint your eyes, they look the same. So the point is that the discretization of the orientation doesn't kill us. I mean, we're still doing a decent job of taking into account the orientation here. So we haven't oversimplified our partition function. That's the point of this exercise. Now, again, why am I doing this? It's because I want to introduce a simple potential of interaction. Unlike perhaps some of you, I'm mathematically challenged, so I have to have simple functions that even I can integrate. All right? So a real, more realistic potential between the wall and a particle in the wall might be something like a Leonard Jones potential. But again, for my purposes, I substitute this Leonard Jones-like potential with a square well potential. Because a square well potential is pretty easy to deal with. And it again, in the spirit of a mesoscopic simulation, I think this has the essentials of an interaction. And I'll show you later on that the results are really something that tells you that the magnitude of the results are such that I think it transcends these kinds of simplifications. So the idea is we have a square well a potential of interaction between the confined particle and the wall, and of course that square well potential can also be a weak repulsive potential if W is positive. In this case, W is negative here. The square well potential has a range, okay? And the idea is that if a particle is outside of the range of that potential, there's no interaction with the wall. And of course, if it intersects the wall, it has an infinite interaction. But if it's in the range of the potential, then it has an interaction energy that's equal to W times the area that it faces, because I'm going to be looking at different shaped particles, okay? So I'm assuming that it's proportional to the area that's within that potential well. Now, what I want to show you is when we do these integrals now, we start to see something really surprising. So this is now a calculation we did for a monomer to a rod-like N-mer, and this is for a dimer and a tetramer. And for this case, I picked a interaction distance that was equal to a tenth of the radius of the confined particle. Right. Okay, so... what you see is a very large effect as a function of the energy of the depth of that well. All right, and the main thing I want you to see is that these effects are happening at very, very large pore sizes. You see, 10 times as large. So this is really. Remember earlier, without the interaction energy, we were seeing those effects taking place at very small pore sizes. No, we're seeing these effects, very, very large effects, at very large pore sizes. It's not dominated by the size of the pore. We don't have to squeeze it into this to see these adsorption effects. So here we're going to look at this in two dimensions. Here's the association enhancement factor for forming a tetramer. And let's just look at one case, since my time is limited. So we're looking at formation of a rod-like tetramer in a square pore, all right? And as we squeeze down, you can see that, yes, you get some effect as you squeeze it down again, but see, we're only twice as large as the monomer. But now what happens as we go to an attractive potential, what we see here is we get a huge enhancement effect at very, very large pore sizes. We get a huge effect. We're looking at 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude. What's going on here? Well, remember I told you that when you don't have any attractive interaction with the pore, remember the pore tends to squeeze stuff out. Materials don't like being confined in a pore, right? So it squeezes the material out. But if you add an attractive interaction, that you get an attraction. It wants to, this here, already -4 kT per monomer, that tends to keep it in the pore. But if you give it 8 kT per monomer, you really soak it into the pore. There's a very large attraction. And just to keep in mind, 8 kT is not a huge amount of energy. We're looking at maybe one hydrogen bond's worth of energy. So this is well within the range of just a purely physical, non-specific adsorption, hydrophobic interaction. This is not a huge energy. So what accounts for this? Why is it going in here? Well, let's look. Since I'm doing all these integrals and I can calculate how much of which is in which state, I'm going to put all the particles that are within the boundary distance, call them bound, put all the particles outside of that as free. Now I can actually count the particles that are bound and free. Well, here I've picked something that's half monomer and half tetramer in bulk, okay? And if I don't have any interaction, basically it's not affected. As we start to close down the pore, there's very little binding, and you basically have half free monomer and half free tetramer. Don't worry about the details here. What I want to show you is that as you go to a more and more attractive interaction, so this is -4 kT per monomer, you start to see binding of tetramer, very little binding of monomer, and by the time you get to 8 kT, what you see is huge, very, very large pore sizes. Doesn't take anything to get this thing up to essentially bound tetramer and almost no bound monomer. Okay? And you can actually now calculate the free energy of binding monomer and the free energy of binding tetramer. So this is 4 times the free energy of binding monomer, and this is the free energy of binding tetramer. And we're plotting this as a function of the actual energy, adsorption energy, per monomer. Okay? And let's look at this. This, the 4 times the free energy of binding a monomer is this. The free energy of binding tetramer is this. It's 10 or 15 kT more negative. It's much, much easier to bind one tetramer than 4 monomers. Why is that? Well, this is very simple. You see, here we have 4 monomers in solution, and there's a potential for it to form a tetramer in solution, okay? Or it can adsorb onto the surface. Now, if we look at this thermodynamic cycle, 4 monomers going to in solution to 4 tetramer on the surface, you know that the free energy, total free energy around this way, has to equal the total free energy around this way, okay? What my calculations show is that negentropically, this is a much more favorable reaction than this is. But you can see that by detailed balance, the fact that this is much more favorable entropically than this means that this must be more favorable entropically than this. And you can see that because what you've done is in both cases you've partially co-localized the system. We've paid part of the price of co-localizing these by adsorbing them. So this is an entropy trap. This pathway is an entropy trap. But you can think of this also as an partial entropy trap for bringing it down to the surface. So what we have is a phenomenon here, which I had called adsorption-linked oligomerization, or vice versa, oligomerization-linked adsorption. The bottom line here is that we would predict that this surface can, in a very non-specific way, attraction, by attracting the monomer, in a very non-specific way, can provide an additional impetus for the adsorbed material to form. You can go all the way from something that's completely monomeric in solution to something that's completely polymerized on the surface. Is this actually happening? Well, let's see. Here's some pretty recent data. Okay, these data were obtained in an entirely different context. They weren't even paying attention to the kinetics here, but I did because I saw something here that really made my ears perk up or my brain perk up. Look at these adsorption curves. These are various different kinds of proteins adsorbing non-specifically onto a phospholipid bilayer. And this is the kinetics of this. It is a Langmuir adsorption curve in dots. It's an exponential adsorption, no interaction on the surface. But look at this. These curves are extremely cooperative, all of them, and they all have a kinetic overshoot. What does that mean? Well, first of all, let me plot that against log time instead of linear time. And when I did that, I saw something, aha! I looked back and I saw a calculation I did a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, and you see, I predicted behavior just like this for a particular model. I don't want to talk about that, but this model says that there must be clustering of proteins in order to produce this kind of behavior. There must be clustering. Moreover, that when this protein comes on down, the process, there's two possible ways you can see it coming. It can come down onto an empty piece of surface, an unoccupied surface, and then merge with the pre-existing cluster. Or it could come down and land on top of this pre-existing cluster and then merge with it. And those data show that this is the preferred pathway. So these molecules are actually, it's cooperative because the target area, you see, is growing as the amount of polymers on there because it's clustering. It has to do it this way. There isn't any other way you can come up with that kind of behavior. Okay, to summarize this part, non-site-specific adsorption, not just flat surfaces, but large relative to the dimensions of of the adsorbing protein, can greatly enhance the association of those adsorbed proteins. And so we predict that these kinds of structural elements could act as nonspecific or semi-specific scaffolds for the self-assembly of functionally important protein complexes. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators on the experimental work, Germán Rivas, who helped me with the studies on fibrinogen, and Danny and Jeff for the amyloid studies, and Damien, who did the light scattering on the tubulin complexes. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Alan, for a very interesting talk. I apologize once again for this machine, which is your temperamental. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm sure there's been a lot of questions already, but there's time for a few more. Chris.
I think Tony will remember this. At the meeting on amyloid in Colorado last week, Andrew Maranka from Yale showed that with IAPP, which is the peptide associated with type 2 diabetes, that you get huge enhancements in the rate of amyloid formation on a bilayer surface.
I wouldn't be surprised at all. I would guess that if a protein is reversibly adsorbing and is free to diffuse in the plane of that surface, this would be a absolute consequence. It would seem to be as fundamental as crowding, and it seems to me that in eukaryotic cells, it might be more important than crowding because the surfaces are ubiquitous, you know.
Good to talk to him because he was hand waving but thinking that this type of mechanism is likely to be applicable, but I'm sure he'd be delighted to. I'll email him.
Oh, great, great, yeah.
What sort of coding you envisage DNA does in a nucleus?
I think it's very crowded. There were some really, I thought, very important experiments conducted by Steve Zimmerman at the NIH in the early mid-90s, where he showed that the binding, and this is an E. coli, looking at E. coli DNA, he showed that the binding of HU, you know, HU coils and compacts the DNA, but the binding of HU and crowding by non-specific polymers or proteins was synergistic. So the binding of the proteins also favored compaction and made it easier for the HU. So you put in a crowding molecule, the affinity for HU goes up. And if you put an HU, then the crowding effect, the amount of crowder you need to produce a certain amount of compaction, decreases. So they were acting synergistically, one specifically and one in a non-specific compaction mode. Is that mean?
Yes, and in a eukaryotic cell, do you think that making nucleosome decreases crowding?
Does it decrease crowding? It's pretty crowded in a nucleus. It's very crowded. Let's put it this way: if you didn't have those, I don't think you can unfold a lot of the DNA at any one time. I think all of these transcription processes involve a kind of a minimal unfolding. Just you do as much as you need in order to get the enzymes in there and do these things, but you can't unfold a great deal of it because there's a huge entropic cost.
Yeah, my question is, wants to say, does a random shaped polymer crowd more than a regularly shaped one? That would be DNA without the chromatin organization.
I would say it's more compact. The more compact, the better. Yes.
So the so the nucleosome is probably less crowded than 3D.
Well, if you were, I don't think you could get that amount of free DNA into that size of volume. That's the.
Sure.
one last short question.
Just a follow up on that. I mean, that's surely a matter of the stiffness of the polymer, because if you go back to a polymer melt, then it's as crowded as it can be, and the chain, random chain or not, doesn't have any effect.
That's true.
It's the stiffness of the DNA that's relevant to your comment there.
Well, There's also, when you get to a certain point, the continuum picture of DNA breaks down and you get transient melting and kinking and
you have an in vitro macromolecular crowding situation with a crowder that has some interaction with itself. Are you going to get phase separation?
You
and
bet.
Also, what if you have interactions between the target protein and
You'll get compensation like we were talking about PEG. PEG has a very large volume excluding effect, but PEG also has attractive interactions with proteins. So theoretically, it's a mess because you have to balance off attractive interactions countermand. I mean, you can conceive of a situation where you could actually get to a theta condition. You see, we're attractive, but that would only occur over a very limited concentration range. So we prefer to do our experiments where we're specifically interested in excluded volume effects on systems where we can verify that we don't have these attractive interactions. But if you have attractive interactions, there are ways of dealing with it that I can talk to you about later in more detail if you're interested.
Let's thank Professor Mithig. We're very interested.